Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I think in this program, we also are calling all you who are ethical eaters and conscientious caretakers of our environment. And
people who want to know more about where to dine in New York City.
And Brooklyn.
A whole lot of interesting stuff. But we're starting out this morning with one of Ann's very favorite people.
Oh, yes,
Michelle
Nijhan,
who has a whole lot to say that's really important.
And I think it's important to realize he's been saying this a long time,
yeah.
And now people are climbing up on the bandwagon, but he really, this is heartfelt from him, and listen.
Yeah, we'll just urge you to spend the next 24 minutes with Ann and Michelle Nijhan talking about things that really are important about the future of eating in America.
Well, I've known Michelle Nijhan for over 15 years, and I must say, Michelle, that everyone talks today about the issues that you talked about way back then, sustainability, wholesome eating. In fact, you have a foundation called The Wholesome Way, and we're going to be talking about your book just released called Sustainably Delicious, which is subtitled Making the World a Better Place, One Recipe at a Time. Now, I think I trust you most because you've never changed. You were consistent, steadfast, and you really deeply, deeply feel these issues.
Well, they are very, very important to me, and it's who I am.
Yeah, well, see, that's it. The honesty of this comes through. But what we were saying about book is everyone can talk about sustainability, and it is a hot talking trend now, but you give us guidelines for how we're able to do that. Is that the purpose of your book?
Yeah, it is one of the purposes of the book, Anne. I feel very, strongly that sustainability should be something that's accessible to everybody. For years, I've been in this movement for so long, almost 30 years now, actually 30 years this year.
Now, how did you get into it?
Well, both my mom and dad were farmers, and they lost their ability to farm. It really was my grandparents on each side of the family that were the last farmers of their generation. It just became unfeasible to remain a small-scale family farmer in America. The agricultural policy had been effectively changed. If you didn't get big, or if you weren't a big corporate conglomerate farm and ran a farm using those conventional methods, it just wasn't viable for you to be in farming anymore. So, I was aware of that. My grandfather on my mom's side of the family, thankfully, was able to hold on to enough of his farm until I was 14 years old when he passed away. And I used to go down and work that farm every summer. And the fact that I was raised on food from that farm, and my mother in our subdivision house in Des Plaines, Illinois, dug up the entire back and side yard to plant her garden, which our neighbors call the farm. I was raised on really good food, so I believed in it from then, and I always felt that the best way we were going to get the best food for ourselves was to deal directly with farmers. So it's something that is in the DNA, so to speak.
Now, it's become, one of the things that's happened is it's become more feasible to do that, hasn't it? Just because of the emergence of farmers markets, and that's of great importance to your movement, so it leads on to that, if you'd like to talk about that next.
Well, absolutely, and that's a great point, Peter. The fact that so many chefs now have come on board, and more every year, thankfully, more and more and more. Yeah, and it's interesting, and you call this a trend, because now all of a sudden it is a trend. It used to be if you were into sustainability, you were a weirdo.
I know, exactly.
Now all of a sudden it's a trend. It feels kind of cool. But that more and more chefs have come on. Chefs have always been a very important part of the community, because new food trends, or the notion of trying something like a tomato that looks green but is actually sweet. Heirloom tomatoes, it was just 20 years ago that we were eating all these pink, perfectly round things that are called tomatoes, but they really aren't.
Yeah, I think they were even talking about producing square ones so that they could actually transport.
Yeah, put on the Wonder Bread, yeah. Trust me, I'm sure they had a couple of prototypes out there. But, the interesting thing was Larry Forgione and Gordon Hammers, who had this war in Massachusetts over these hobby heirloom tomatoes, so that they could have a menu edge over each other, because they were the top two chefs at the time, And the interesting notion is that chefs bring something to dining customers and they eat it and they find it amazing and delicious. They start going and challenging the grocery managers. And I say it's because of Larry Forgio and Gordon Hammersley that there are heirloom tomatoes in every Stop and Shop, every grocery chain in America during tomato season now. So it's an interesting thing. So being able to have the restaurant and being able to see so many chefs come on board and increase the demand, and then the number of farmers markets has over 20 years has gone from 60 to over 5,000 now. It's made it much easier for chefs and restaurateurs to be able to buy locally.
But you're doing something even more significant with your Wholesome Wave movement, which is the next step. And to me, it's the step that this book is about,
yeah,
because you're presenting sustainability as a family option and a home cooking option. And until now, that must have been much more difficult. I mean, even if you wanted to do it, as Anne's mother did. Anne's mother had a sustainable garden almost as big as your mother did in whatever you called her residence in our tiny little urban plot in Pittsburgh. But translating that into a range of recipes that are within the ability of a home cook is to me, a really important step for us. But secondly, you've got this important step that you've also found a way to make the grocery dollar grow larger for people who really need it.
Right. Well, I appreciate that, Peter. With Sustainably Delicious, the book, what I wanted to look at was how do you make it really successful and accessible to be able to be successful as a family making moves towards sustainability. And for so many years in this movement, the 30 years I've been in it, many of the voices of the movement have been very hardcore and very unyielding. It was once thought that if you wanted to buy organic, it was an all-or-nothing proposition.
Oh, yeah.
That you really had to change everything. And as a father of five children, my wife and I, and the course that I chose, because keeping in mind that sustainability is just recently a new trend or a fad, I've been doing it my entire chef's career, and I had to bypass a lot of the television opportunities that many of my contemporaries are enjoying today because I couldn't accept sponsorships from companies like Kraft and so on. So we, as my career moved forward as a chef, I was also in a family on a budget and trying to make the decisions of how I can feed my children better food, knowing what I know about our food system. So we just learned to make certain steps, such as, just making one choice locally and organically can make a huge difference, which is why I encourage folks in the book, if it's pick something that your kids love the most, if it's grapes or apples or milk, choose that one thing, and this season go to a farmer's market and buy local organic milk or apples or whatever it is. Buy that from a farmer's market and imagine what would happen if 40% of American households did that. It would change the apple or the dairy industry. So people actually can have a significant impact making one choice at a time. And what we also found as we were making our own personal choices as a family, the more we were thinking about and feeling good about feeding our children better food, the more excited we became, and we would look at other things, and it would be Christmas time. Instead of getting them the newest, latest toy of some kind, we would really be more thoughtful about and budget the way we treated our kids around their birthdays and the holidays. What are we really buying them as gifts? How much does it cost? How much are we spending? What is the real value of these things? And we found that it was easier to put more money into our food budget just by changing some of our other purchasing decisions. So I thought it was important to lay out things that folks could do at their home, in their kitchen, things as simple as having the little fillable soap sponge pad. You can actually afford, a sustainable green cleaning dish soap if you fill one of those things, and every time you eat, you actually just briefly wash and rinse your plate off and put it back in the cupboard instead of just stacking the dishwasher full of dishes for a couple of days and then turning it on, wasting it all that power, and then needing that type of egregious kind of dishwasher chemical. You actually save money doing it the way that I just mentioned it. So it's interesting. You learn those things over time, and I think those are the type of real-life techniques that haven't been shared because most of the people that have been writing and speaking to organics and sustainability at home have been people that have come from families of means and haven't had to do it on a budget. So I wanted that to be the work that we did with Sustainably Delicious.
Now couple that with a Wholesome Wave and this absolutely totally ingenious idea.
Well, you know,
the people who you would think would be the furthest away from buying organically at farmers markets can all of a sudden get twice the value.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, the interesting notion is even when I look at the market for Sustainably Delicious, it's not an inexpensive book. It's $30, I believe, and $34 in Canada. So it's not an inexpensive book.
No, it's actually $35 in the U.S. and $44.50 in Canada.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Whoops. You obviously have the book in front of you.
I do.
That's excellent.
If you buy from Michelle, you get a discount.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, so the book still is, I would say, you know, middle class. You know, middle class to, you know, upper middle class and beyond, affordable, accessible there, and others that are home cooked of lesser income. But when I look at the food system overall as a whole, for us to really get where we need to be, to have enough farmland in production, to have enough market demand to where we shift away from this heavily conventional system that's basically pumping our communities full of cheap calories that metabolize so quickly they create obesity. For us to get away from that, we need a significant size market. And even if you add all of those 5,000 farmers markets and you take the affluent community restaurants that can actually afford to buy locally and serve organic food, you put them all together and they represent probably less than 1% of all of retail food sales. That's not going to change our food system. Unless a larger population really can step up to the plate, a larger market, then we're kind of the dire straits because we do need our food system to shift back. So we took a look at the two populations that are kind of the missing quotient and generally don't participate in buying local food or organics or natural foods. And that's middle class America, middle America, which is where I come from, and all of my family is still there. You know, southern Illinois, western Tennessee and Kentucky, Mississippi, Alabama. I have relatives in Ohio. You know, I understand the mentality of that population. So, and that's the larger population of America. And another large, very forgotten population are underserved communities. And these are the urban areas. All of our cities have them, the forgotten neighborhoods that are incredibly underserved, and then seriously underserved rural communities out in the farmlands where a lot of our conventional food's being produced. But there are families that really have no access to decent employment. So these are people that are just above, at, or below the poverty level. And it's a very large population. We really chose to work with that population for a couple of reasons. One is, in that population, obesity, childhood diabetes, adult diabetes, type 2 diabetes in children is rampant. These are the communities that really in the worst shape, both urban and rural. They're so limited in the resources that they have for food that they really have to buy the cheapest food that their money can buy, which is converted rice, cup of noodles, you know, hamburger helper without the hamburger. They're not eating at McDonald's every day. I really get angry when I hear people go off on how, oh yeah, these people on food stamps are spending them on hamburgers and Happy Meals. They can't even afford to go to McDonald's every day. If they do buy their children a Happy Meal, it's on a Sunday because they're making a desperate attempt to have their kids feel like some of the other kids. They really are looking at the choice of, okay, I have a family of four. I have $2. Do I buy a head of broccoli for $1.89, or do I buy a four-pack of cup of noodles for $1.69 and put a bowl of something hot in front of each of the family members? Those are the choices that they're faced with. So our chairman, Gus Schumacher, and I had been talking about this for years and working in some underserved communities, especially with refugee populations, and we were noticing that they had a passion for fruits and vegetables and then a matching frustration that they couldn't afford them. Okay. So we felt that it was a great target population to try this incentive program. So it simply works this way. We raise private funds, and then we go into communities that have seriously underserved communities that are either near a farmer's market or have a nonprofit that's been trying to work with food access to improve the health of these seriously at-risk populations. And we will open a farmer's market offering double the food assistance dollars, whether it's WIC benefits, which are supplemental nutrition assistance for women, infants, and children, or the SNAP benefits, which are more popularly known as food stamps.
Right.
So the notion is if you choose to spend your federal food assistance dollars on cup of noodles or minute rice or even a Twinkie, knock yourself out. But if you choose to come to a farmer's market that's participating and buy fresh fruits and vegetables, you double your money. We launched it 2 years ago in 3 states and about 8 markets, and it's become so wildly popular and successful. We're now in 18 states, 160 markets, working through almost 30 nonprofit partners to administer the benefits. So it really has worked. And the thing that makes me happy is it's completely disproved that if you drop fruits and vegetables in the middle of an underserved community, whether it's rural or urban, that they won't know what to do with them. Everybody buys them enthusiastically. They know exactly what to do with fresh fruits and vegetables. They just can't afford them.
Now, if someone wants to get, you're in lots of areas already, but there are also probably lots of parts of the country where people have never heard of this. And I am guessing are probably on the menu listeners, probably not substantial in the underserved communities because they probably don't have the online capability or iPods or whatever to be able to listen to us. But certainly among our listener base, there are people who would think this is a great idea and they'd like to support it. Now, how do they get started?
Well, there are a few ways. One is if they just love the programming and they're just compelled to support it, they can go to wholesomewave.org, which is our website. And there are a variety of ways that they can determine areas that we're working that might be in a community near them that they can either support directly or they can support us through a donation. Or if they're interested in bringing this type of programming to their community, whether it's on a volunteer basis or folks belong to or know the local community foundations or nonprofits that are working with these communities that would be excited by this type of program, just call our office and make the connection. What we find, we're not an endowed foundation. We are an operating foundation, so we have to raise funds to do the work we do. But in many cases, there have been citizens that have read, visiting one area where we're working, where there have been newspaper articles or they've gone online and read about it, and then they've called their local community foundations who have then gotten in touch with us to ask us to come in and help them set the program up within their community.
That sounds fabulous.
Yeah, that's how you do it, because I mentioned to you about a really wonderful farmer's market we have in Pittsburgh, and they said it's too difficult to get into the program as a farmer's market.
Well, no, it's actually not that complicated, and we'd be thrilled to speak with them and just help them understand it a little better.
Yeah, that's probably misinformation is what I would think.
Well, no, it's been actually, you know, it's what one of the things we're very proud of, Anne, is that we've actually achieved some administrative and grant-level policy change in the 2.5 short years we've been doing this. 2 years before today, and still in some states that haven't encountered this style of programming, it could be very difficult to have SNAP access at a farmer's market.
Uh-huh.
Very difficult. And fortunately, a lot of the information that's still out there is on the way it used to be done before we came along.
I got you.
And,
yes.
You know, it's interesting because if you're a food retailer, it's really easy. You get a wired electronic benefit machine because all of these benefits now come on credit card type things so they can be swiped and controlled easier, and
uh-huh.
It prevents fraud, and it's less of a stigma for the holder. The supermarkets and the bodegas and the gas stations and the liquor stores that sell food get those machines for free so that they can accept SNAP benefits. If you're a farmer's market, you don't have a phone line. You have to get a wireless machine, and they cost $1,000 each.
I see.
And then also, you have to sign this egregious retail food contract like you're a big grocery store, and the language is so ominous because it's fraud preventative that you get a farmer's market with a part-time market master, and they basically have to sign away 3 kids and a couple of organs in the event that there's fraud, and they just don't want to sign.
Yeah.
So we've actually, our work has resulted in streamlining that process. It's much easier to get approved for SNAP at farmers markets now, and there's a lot less paperwork as a result of our work, because we also, while we work at the grassroots level in communities like Pittsburgh, we're not there yet, would love to come there. While we work on the ground, we also work in Washington directly with both the mid-level, top-level administrators in all of the USDA agencies, as well as the elected and appointed officials there, informing them of the successes on the ground. We're not lobbying them. We're not going to them with a ton of money saying, here's money, do this for us. We're working in just a very effective, direct way. And when they see the success and they see that we've set the program up so that it's not threatening to anybody and that it is effective and that it's reaching these communities and getting them better quality, healthier food, they've been very quick to say, and then, of course, we share with them what the challenges are to making it more successful more broadly, and they've worked to make it easier. So it's really been terrific. And as a result of those relationships, I don't know if you recall, but about 3 or 4 weeks ago, the White House Childhood Obesity Task Force released their action plan, and one of the 70 points for policy change is our program named specifically the Wholesome Wave Double Value Coupon Program. So,
oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, we're really, really pleased at the progress that we've been able to make, and we have great hope that this can actually become a more permanent part of the American landscape.
Oh, wouldn't we wish, huh? Michelle, I guess what we need to take away from this is, first of all, everybody should check out the Wholesome Wave website, right?
Yes.
Which is
wholesomewave.org, right?
.org. And something we haven't really emphasized enough, I think, is that your cookbook is appropriately named. I mean, it's not only about sustainability, but recipes are delicious, and so are the photographs, by the way. They're yummy.
Yeah, Andre Baranowski is the photographer, and he just did. He has such a great spirit, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because the book is delicious, and I really wanted to. You know, it's interesting, because my first cookbook was so technically difficult. It's when I was, it's before my first son was diagnosed with diabetes. I was on this trajectory to become the four-star chef. And I was aiming at and was being courted by the Food Network. And then Chris got sick with type 1 diabetes, and I started studying diabetes and really learned how food has not only a tremendous impact on your potential outcome if you're suffering from diabetes, but a variety of other health concerns as well. I did an about-face. I did taste when I thought I could do a cooking of well-being, but I couldn't let go of my ego. So it was, it was this really technical, really overly presented stuff, and very difficult for the home cook to do.
Yeah, we never cooked anything out of it.
No.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that, because you would have been invoking my name in vain, Peter, several times. You would have been like,
"How
you
getting
this damn corn juice to work now?"
I even told you that about that book. You know?
Yeah,
this is wholesome ingredients. Simple steps, less expensive cuts of meat used creatively with spices and braises.
You know what?
That's the kind of thing I can do.
I love your description of it in summation, Rabbit. Peter said, Michelle, it's just very sensible. Everything you're writing about is sensible.
Well, it's so much of it is, and a lot of the techniques are, it's the food I was raised on. I put my mom's smothered pork chops in there. I mean, it's got stuff in there that's the type of home cooking that fills your house with good smells. Mm-hmm. It's easy to do. The ingredients are easy to find. And when you look at, and I'm glad you brought up the secondary cuts, Peter, because when you do use secondary cuts instead of aiming at center cut pork chops when you are going to cook meat for your family on a weekend, and you go with pork shoulder instead, you actually have more money to spend on things like locally grown organic rutabaga or beets or whatever it is that you want. You can actually go to the farmer's market because you're not blowing all your money on more expensive cuts of meat. So I tried to keep the book as sensible as it could be so that it actually could give people tools and actions that they could take to live more sustainably, but also to be able to afford it.
Well, I just checked now just to make sure, and you do not have pickled watermelon rinds, which is what I remember from my farm days.
Oh, you know, it's so funny. I should have put watermelon pickles in there.
Yeah, but you had
next book.
You had to stop the book at some point. I think that the work you're doing is wonderful. I think the concept is just absolutely totally brilliant, and I hope more people get on board. And as always, Michelle, it's a delight to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise. So great to hear both of your voices.
You too.
Really appreciate the time that you've given me today.
Well, we appreciate you. In our mutual love society, we all love each other. Okay, dear, and thank you.
I wish you'd stop saying that.
Well, take good care. So great
you
to
too.
Be with you again.
Ciao.
So long now.
Bye.
What do you say after that except amen? I think you say it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're moving on. You know how it is when people become so famous, they're known by a single name. Well, we have two of those coming up, collectively known by a single name, the Frankies. And then we have a blossoming new culinary scene in New York, a.k.a. Brooklyn, and we're going to tell you how to move around there. So let's listen first to the Frankies and then to the Food Lover's Guide to Brooklyn.
We're going to meet the Frankies, and you all better be nice. Hey, hello, Frank Falsinelli and Frank Castronovo. And I guess where mine is poor Peter Meehan. He never gets on the interviews, although he does a lot of writing on these cookbooks. We're going to talk about your latest book, and it's called The Frankies with no plural. What are we? Possessive. No possessive. Splintino.
No comma.
A Splintino, Kitchen Companion, and Cooking Manual. This is a fun book, but you're fun people.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, well, I must say, I mean, I remembered meeting the Frank Falsinelli at a out-of-house beard dinner. He was one of, I think there were five chefs cooking, and you seemed to be fun, but you were involved with a different concept at the time. Was that Mumba?
Yeah, that was Mumba.
So this is you just took a total change, an alternate fork in the road, and tell us what you're doing now.
Right now we're doing the Frankie Spintino, and we're doing Cafe Peddler, and we're doing Prime Meats, which is a farm-to-table German restaurant that we have in Brooklyn.
Okay, now, do you have one or two Frankie Spintinos?
We have two Frankie Spintinos right now.
Okay, one's in Brooklyn, and the other one's in Manhattan?
Yep, it's on the Lower East Side on Clinton Street.
Okay. That would be easy to get to. We have to do that next time we're there.
The beginnings of our country, immigration, is started on Clinton Street on the Lower East Side.
That's Wiley Dufresne's. WD-50's on Clinton Street,
and
right?
He's there, too.
Yeah,
exactly,
he's a good
right down the street. We're a block away.
Oh, well, we've been there a lot. So, first of all, the first thing that you notice is the design of this book. I mean, it's got gilt edges. Tell us about this design.
It looks a little bit like a Bible.
Looks like a Bible. It looks like a late 1800s, turn of the century, typical book. The content of the book is also typical to that era in that it's a cooking companion and kitchen guide, or vice versa. It's a concise, compiled, basically greatest hits of all the things that we do at our restaurants, but laid out in the format of like a books of that era when everything was handcrafted. It's pre-industrial revolution.
It's the sort of thing that if grandma ever took the time to write a book, this is what it would look like.
If grandma ever took the time to write a book and she was referring to what she grew up with, that's what it would come out to be.
That's what I thought. Is that what you were trying to capture?
We're trying to capture the golden age of craftsmanship in our, like we do in our food, and pretty much what, when things were still, before they were mass produced, how they came out with illustrations.
I love those illustrations. Who's that artist?
Sarah Rutherford.
Very, very. I love them.
And she was an employee of ours.
Really?
Yeah, she was a waitress at 17 Clinton Street And she used to do up chalkboards and our menu boards, and she had such a great style, and she knew how to work it within the same style as what our restaurants. So it was great for her to be able to design everything, because she kind of knew what the dishes were. She served them and eaten them 1,000. She knew our aesthetic, so it was pretty easy to have her be the illustrator. Same thing goes for Travis Kaufman, who designed and did the layout of the book. He's our partner.
Oh, okay.
And Peter Meehan, the writer, has been a friend of ours for years. So it was all put together in house, and we all tried to. We all knew what our objective was. We all had the same goal in mind, and fun to do, because it wasn't just a project or a conceptual thing. It was a vision of all of. A collaborative vision, and it was really, really fun.
It's sort of like a celebration of Italian-American cooking and upbringing and the whole thing, isn't it?
Yes.
That's the way I read it.
Yeah, it's a celebration of what we're doing over there at Frankie Spuntino. It's a true representation of our restaurant.
But your restaurant became your restaurant because of something before that.
Yeah, a restaurant became that because of a lot of things. Families immigrated here 100 years ago. And they've worked in New York for 100 years, and this is kind of like the fruits of our labor for Frank and our careers, 25 years plus, and our families, 2 and 3 generations of Italian-American immigrants to New York over about 100 years. So this is our book.
It sure is. What launched you to do it right now, when you've already expanded into other areas? Why this book? Why not? Of course, I don't know why you have a German restaurant. You might tell me about that.
Why not?
Well, that's it. I'm saying, what now motivated you?
Time was right. The time was right because we've been open for 6 years, and we had an opportunity with Peter and with Travis and all the know-how
and artists
and our publisher kind of pretty much came at the right time. You know, which is. It's a lot of things happen with us because it's meant to happen at this time. It's just a natural progression. We weren't, we were kind of like talking about doing a book, and people had been saying you guys should do a book. And we were very serious about doing a book, the style of book that we did. And Artisan was the perfect publisher to work with, because they saw a group of people that had a vision and had an idea, and they let us go with it. It was a wonderful experience all around with a great publisher like Artisan, who is known for making beautiful books.
But what's the recipes in here? Are recipes are they dumbed down from what you do?
They're actually family recipes that we started out with.
Okay.
When we started Frankie's Spuntino, and then we adapted them to the restaurant. You know, we took the recipes apart. We clarified the technique, and we focused on the ingredients, and they were originally grandma's recipes. And
see, how did you get in?
Now they're getting reverted back into form a recipe that our grandmothers would have used, and except for it's explained by professional chefs who have a restaurant that they practice that menu every day, and the recipes are accessible to get that grandma flavor in your own home every day, and that's why we call it a kitchen companion and cooking manual. Because we want it to be something that's on your shelf, on your counter, and when you want to make those recipes for your family and friends, you just have to reach for it, and it's that go-to thing where illustrations, it's clear, concise information, it's explained by professional chefs, and you'll never get tired of looking at it.
And how did you ever get the recipes out of your grandmother? I mean,
it wasn't easy.
I mean, my grandmother, when I tried to get recipes out of her, thought that I was retarded. You know, she just, you know, asking these stupid questions.
We got a lot of that, but when they saw that we were sincere about it, because we come from French training backgrounds, once they saw that we were really serious about it, they helped out as much as possible, and other family members helped out, and we sought out those ingredients that to recreate that flavor. Because, you know, it's you'd be surprised how difficult it is to get grandma's flavor.
Oh, no, I would not be surprised. I mean, I have no hope of ever being able to recreate any of my grandmother's recipes.
But we felt that, you know, when you have a book like this and you have a restaurant that ours,
where it's a mainstay in the community, and it's you know, that people have been wanting recipes and how to recreate that flavor for a long time now, and it feels good to give it to them, you know, finally.
Now, but these aren't, you're not proposing that these are absolutely authentic reproductions of your grandmother's recipes.
No, they're adaptations, you know.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, my grandmother never used avocado.
You know, it's an adaptation. Like I said, we took apart their recipes as professional chefs. So you get the benefit of being able to get the flavor with the explanation on the technique.
Can you give an example maybe of one dish, kind of the change that you made to it? I mean, this is grandma made it this way, and here's how we clarified that. I mean, any one at all that's...
Yeah, the two dishes that we basically swapped out the sauce and the technique for was cavatelli and gnocchi. Grandma made cavatellis with tomato sauce and ricotta, and we make cavatellis with brown sage butter and sausage and sage, and grandma made gnocchi, and she sometimes did a little white sauce or a butter sauce on the gnocchi, and we put tomato sauce on the gnocchi. So we basically switched what did at home or what we've experienced before and for the restaurant. And they work, and they're interchangeable.
Uh-huh. Now, the thing that really caught my eye is your puntarelle salad, puntarella. I've never been able to get that here.
No, it's also dandelion greens, which are the closest thing to it.
Yeah, well, I can get those.
So is that what you're using?
It's very similar to the dandelion greens. They have that bitter, stemmy, you know. But the thing about those is they're great for sautéing, and they're great for a really strong dressing. You know, like that's why we use the anchovy parsley dressing on top, because it holds up to the bitterness with the salt.
Now, we had someone in...
it's a Roman dish.
It was in Trastevere in Rome. Somebody demonstrated how you actually cut this, what they look like, and then how you cut them up to make a salad. It was really fun. And then, of course, we chowed down and ate it as well.
Yeah, they sliced the stem very thin into very thin strips, and they all curled, and then they made it into a salad.
And we got some, and we tried to do that with it, and it didn't work worth a damn.
I tried growing it. It was a joke.
the part of it I liked was your plan for a sundae. Large section of the book is about how to recreate sundae with instructions.
Yeah, that came out of knowing that there is definitely a structured timeline, and it's easy for us because we've experienced it and we've been there. But for the average reader that is going to pick up the book, it's nice to know that they can pick it up and get a sense of what the timing is, whether they keep it or not, of where they're supposed to be, what they're supposed to be shopping for, where they're supposed to be shopping for it. Again, getting the information and getting it clearly and delivered professionally was the paramount, you know, and that's what the inspiration was for. So you're staying on track, and you know, you're like, listen, where am I supposed to be right now? I'm 4 hours into this. I have no idea. I'm supposed to be boiling pasta water, or I'm supposed to be going to get bread. So it's really clear to the reader, and it's a good guideline.
You're recreating one of the world's great dining experiences, right? Which is going to grandma's house on Sunday lunch after you've been to church or whatever else you were doing in the morning.
Exactly, and it's visual. It's a timeline, so you can easily, just like we use a lot of stuff like that with the vegetable roasting guide.
And I like that too, yeah, because that's
a
tough one.
Whenever you see a box that has lines around it, those are the production notes that Frank and I painstakingly went over and said, what, as the home cook or the person reading this book, what is the most important thing at this moment to tell them so that they know, so they can recreate it themselves?
Cheat notes.
Yeah, the little cheat sheet.
Right.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with cheating as long as you get away with it.
Now, you guys, are you still using induction cookery, cooking stuff?
Yeah, we're big fans of the...
I'm in love with that stuff. I don't have
it. Cook tax. It keeps down the radiant heat, which a lot of... You know, you're using electricity, but at least the electricity is going right into the pot, and you're getting the maximum heat for it, whereas it's going around the pot and going up the ventilation system. So it's actually a lot more efficient than gas heat.
Yeah, I mean, I encountered them in England the first time, I guess it was. A lot of chefs. That's a chef's toy that's really popular in England.
Yeah.
In Europe.
Oh, yeah, they really work. They're good for a lot of different circumstances.
Oh, they're wonderful. They're like miracle. Tell me what is there something else about this book that, that we should mention? I also wanted, how about a general website for you guys?
Everything, the book's available from Amazon.com or on our website.
Yeah, you can buy it on our website, too. So
Well,
you will be able to when I get it put on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what's your website? Your
website is frankiespuntino.com, and it has links to pictures of the restaurant, menus, media, stuff that we've done in the past, Prime Meat, and our new restaurant that's German farm-to-table restaurant.
Well, we hope you're open for Sunday lunch so we can experience what it was
open,
like at Grandma's house.
We're open every day at Frankie's from 11 a.m. to midnight, and we're open every day at Prime Meat from 7 a.m. to 1 a.m.
That's incredible.
So you're busy guys.
Yeah, we open. We from our travels and our experiences, we realize that people want to be able to eat all day long. Really don't want to be confined to meal periods, and they always want value, and they want service and hospitality, and that's what we're there for.
Well, I'm sure it's a wonderful experience, and I'm sure we're going to make sure we enjoy it the next time we're in New York. And in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us on the menu, and let's remind ourselves, what's the name of the book, sweetheart?
It's the Frankie's Spuntino Kitchen Companion and Cooking Manual. And I wanted to mention the quote here.
Go ahead.
From the book. It says, Grandma never broke a sweat, neither should you. And I hope that's true, making these recipes. This is my childhood, too, you know, looking at these recipes. So I can hardly wait to start cooking it up.
That's great. We're confident that you're going to have a great time with it.
Thank you so much, you guys, and good luck with it.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too, Franks, both
bye-bye.
Of you.
Bye.
Bye. We're talking to an award-winning travel writer who discovered that she had been writing for years about all the glories of the world, around the world, and right in her own backyard, something big was happening. I welcomed on the menu Sherry Eisenberg, and your book is fascinating to me, Food Lover's Guide to Ta-ta, Brooklyn. Now, yeah, I mean, because I noticed the same phenomenon, that what used to be the boondocks is now, that's where everything's happening. Art and food at the shops, small entrepreneurial ventures, the whole thing.
It is. It's a very exciting time for Brooklyn, both for people who live here and for people who are visiting Brooklyn. There's a lot going on.
Now, why?
That's a good question. I think some of the food ventures that are going on now are chefs who originally started out their careers in important Manhattan kitchens, and when they wanted to start their own restaurants, they wanted something small and casual and in their own neighborhood. And the atmosphere is very different in Brooklyn. Even when the quality of the food is high and the prices are high, the atmosphere is always much more casual in Brooklyn. You can wear jeans almost anywhere.
No, is one of the driving forces the fact that many people moved to Brooklyn just because it was much more affordable than the city of Manhattan?
I think it started out that way, and it became something different. Now the people that I know who are making their lives in Brooklyn, a lot of them are not doing it because they can't afford Manhattan. They're doing it because they prefer the atmosphere here. And it's become its own thing as opposed to a satellite of Manhattan. It has its own personality, and the people who spend their time here prefer that.
Now, I think it has more than one personality, if I can say that. And that leads me on to the next area that you cover, which is that no, there isn't a singular Brooklyn. There's a Brooklyn that's made up of a wide variety of different neighborhoods, and perhaps you can talk about a couple of those for us.
You know, the neighborhoods in Brooklyn, a lot of them function like small towns. And what I found when I started working on the book was that, for example, if you live in Carroll Gardens, you might know all of the wonderful cannoli shops and places to buy Italian breads and Italian cookies and the little Italian places to buy handmade pasta, but you might not know the neighborhood two over from yours. You might not know what amazing things there are to find in Park Slope or what amazing things there are going on right now in Williamsburg. And I think that a lot of people really do stick to sort of a 15-block radius from their home. And I know that I did before I started working on this book, too. So I think that for people who are very, very familiar with their own neighborhood, there still will be things to learn about other neighborhoods in the book.
Now, can you give us an example of a couple of neighborhoods that are, you think are really hot, and then a couple that are not so hot that are getting there?
Okay, I think Williamsburg is really exciting right now.
Oh, yeah.
There have been some great restaurant openings there in the last 5 years, and plenty of places that are worth crossing the bridge for, even for diehard Manhattanites. Pies and Thighs makes some of the best fried chicken in the city, and they just reopened a few months ago. And I think that Fitzau, I always pronounce it wrong, is doing great barbecue, and that's another good place that's worth coming to. And I really like Fatty Q, which is Zach Palacio's Asian-inspired barbecue restaurant.
Right.
That's another one that's worth going to.
Now, one of our chef friends from Pittsburgh moved there and opened a small restaurant, but I can't remember who it was. I was just going to check to see.
Can't remember who it was. It really doesn't matter, does it?
I won't remember till later.
And you're expecting me to remember, and the answer is I don't remember.
You'll think of it later.
Yeah, I know when it's too late, probably.
Now, what about somewhere that's a little farther out? Because Williamsburg also has the advantage that it's almost in Manhattan.
It is. And I think that some of the neighborhoods that have the more interesting restaurant openings right now are in fairly close proximity to Manhattan. And that's how they're able to draw, you know, both a big local crowd and a crowd of people who travel around the boroughs looking for the best food. I found some really exciting food in every neighborhood I went to, though. So it's very hard to single out one in my head.
But it's important for listeners to understand that from an organizational standpoint, you have two categorizations. The first breakdown is geographical,
yes,
by neighborhood, which is extremely useful. And then you have a number of categories within each of those neighborhoods.
Right. So then I broke it down by restaurants that you should go to, and then also sort of the classic restaurants that weren't as new or fresh, but certainly had a place in Brooklyn's history. And then I also wrote about places to buy food and people who are making food, and there are also recipes in the book. So in each chapter, it definitely goes beyond just restaurants.
Well, this is packed full of information, Sherry. I mean, how long did it take you to write this?
You know, it was a really short time frame that I had to do the reporting, and so I think from start to finish, it was a little bit over a year. But I had to turn in, I guess I signed the contract with the publisher in May, and I had to turn in the entire manuscript the first week in October.
Holy Moses.
So it was really tense. It was really tight. Time was definitely not on my side with this one. I had to make sure that I went to a new restaurant every single night, and I had to try to get to 20 to 30 places every weekend. Now, some of those weren't restaurants. They were butchers or seafood stores or bakeries, but it was a really intense experience.
But you did all of them yourself?
I did. I went to every single place by myself in the book. On the weekends when I was doing, for example, 10 tacos in Sunset Park, I would bring friends with me so that they would eat some of the food and there was less waste and more people's opinions. And that was really helpful. But no, I did go to every single place in the book, and that was definitely a difficult part of the project.
Oh, it's tough. I mean, we're well-trained. We're
yes.
experts
yes.
in this. For
you
years.
Learn not to finish your plate very quickly.
Oh, yeah. So, but I mean, it's tough, I know.
Now, it is. It can be really hard.
Here's one of the biggest challenges of a book like this. How do you plan on keeping it up to date?
You know, as my publisher says that they're committed to doing the next edition as soon as we feel like it's necessary, and, you know, assuming that this one sells well, they're planning to do that.
Oh, no, that's good.
Yeah, so that's nice. It's nice that they're committed to that.
Now, the other advantage you have, I guess, that you wouldn't have had 10 years ago is probably most everywhere in there has an internet address. They have a website so people
exactly.
can check easily.
Yes, everywhere has a website if they have one and the phone number. And so, you know, if anybody's worried a year from now when they pick up the book that it's been out for a little while, they can always check before they go to the place and make sure that nothing's changed.
Now, do you have plans to do another part of the world?
You know, people keep telling me I should do the Food Lover's Guide to Queens, but I think Queens is just as much of an enormous project as Brooklyn is.
I didn't know anything was going on in Queens. Is there really?
Oh, yeah, there's lots of good stuff going on in Queens.
I block it out. I haven't been there. I remember feeling totally stranded once when I went there.
It doesn't get the same buzz that Brooklyn has. It doesn't have the same energy, but it has a lot of amazing food finds.
Yeah.
And if you're looking for Indian food, some of the best Indian food in New York City is in Queens. If you're looking for Greek, some of the best Greek food in New York City is in Queens.
Yeah, that would be
and,
true.
And, you know, some of the immigrant groups that didn't settle in Brooklyn settled in Queens, and so those types of cuisines are better found there than they are in Brooklyn.
But you're wedded to Brooklyn, at least for the time being, huh?
I mean, this is where I live, and so it's definitely something that I care about.
Let's just reference a couple of things for people who are going to be visiting Brooklyn from away from New York and have never been there. So Brooklyn is a little different. It's reachable on a variety of subways, correct?
Yes, it is. And for every restaurant and store in the book, I give the subway information.
Oh, that's wonderful. And the last thing we should mention, we talked about this before we came on the air, so I know this is not a surprise. I found on business visits that I made to Brooklyn that you might be able to get a taxi to take you there, but you don't find the same number of taxis cruising the streets as you do in Manhattan. So finding a return cab might sometimes be difficult. Now, you've said your experience was that you always found one, but what's the scoop?
I have been so lucky. I always get a cab. I'll be in a neighborhood where people say, you're never going to get a cab, and one will show up just when I need one. So it hasn't been my experience that it's hard, but it does depend on what neighborhood you're in. And if you're in a neighborhood where you don't see a lot of yellow cabs whizzing by, all of the restaurants have the phone numbers for car services that for about the same price as a cab will take you wherever you want to go and will come pick you up. So anywhere where you can't get a cab, the restaurant can call a car service for
right,
you.
Black car services. Mm-hmm. That's in fact how I used to find my way out of Brooklyn when I was getting out of there, usually going to the airport. So it is possible to get around. There are probably buses as well, but that's maybe even harder. But you've done the spade work of saying this is the nearest subway stop. Done a great service to, first of all, potential visitors to Brooklyn, but also to the Brooklyn community itself. Are they going to make a medal for you?
Well, you know, I had a lot of help. There are some really amazing websites that make traveling around the city a lot easier. For example, I use HopStop a lot, and it's a website where you put in where you are in New York City and where you're going, and it'll give you subway directions or bus directions or walking directions, or it'll tell you how much a cab would cost.
Oh,
and it'll
wonderful.
Also give you phone numbers for local car services.
Now, what's it called again?
HopStop, HopStop.com.
Oh,
I found them very helpful.
Oh, that sounds great.
There's also an online map of New York City that has the subway embedded into it. It's called, I believe it's onnyturf.com. And what's really great about that is that on a normal map, you're not going to see necessarily the subway routes. But on this map, you can really tighten in on a neighborhood, see where it is you're going, and see what the closest subways are. And so I find that really helpful, too.
Well, that's a fantastic piece of work that you've done.
And I wanted to say that it's as valuable for people living in Brooklyn as it is for people going
there. Oh, sure,
there.
Yes, absolutely.
To some degree. I am a traveler, and because I didn't grow up in Brooklyn, I imagine that some people in specific neighborhoods will feel like, because they have lived there for decades, they know it inside and out, and I'm definitely not telling them anything new. So I always make sure that I say that caveat. You know, I'm not from here. I didn't grow up here. This is my adopted home. And I think certainly people who live in Brooklyn might learn a lot about other neighborhoods, but I don't think I'm telling, you know,
right.
someone who's spent their whole life in their neighborhood.
You do lists of food festivals, culinary events, insider information about flea markets, green markets, and that kind of thing. So I think that we have an enormous amount of information, Jerry. And I hope that this book moves well and that they keep it updated. And I think it's great.
Thank you. You know, you mentioned flea markets, and I think the Brooklyn Flea has actually been an amazing incubator for the food scene in Brooklyn. I don't know if you've ever been there before, but there are a lot of great young food companies coming out of the Brooklyn Flea. And now some of those people have created great catering businesses and have started opening up their own stores. That's actually been one of the great sparks for why Brooklyn is so exciting right now.
Well, that's good to know. Well, listen, keep us posted, and let us know where you're off to next.
Absolutely.
You're an absolutely amazing researcher.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
And we'll be talking to you, Sherry.
Good talking to you, too.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Stick with us while we take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, On the Menu is continuing its conversations with our celebrity guests.
Well, of course we are. That's what we do.
That's what we do.
That's what we do here.
And our next guest has an interesting background. She'll tell us all about that. I just wanted to introduce it by saying that there seems to be, well, food comes at people in a number of different ways, in a number of different times in their lives, but it just is getting to be like a universal magnet, isn't it?
It is, and Sally Cameron's an unusual magnet,
yeah.
And she's involved in an unusual event that I think we thought you'd be interested in, as well as in her own story.
Every chef, it seems, has a story to tell, and Sally Cameron is by way far no exception. She has lots of stories to tell. Welcome to On the Menu, Sally.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's just jump back a little bit. Your path to chefdom was a little bit different than most people's.
Yeah, it was pretty different. People always laugh and raise their eyebrows when they hear my story.
Well, tell us.
Well, I was fortunate to grow up with a mom who cooked and entertained a lot, and she was a real kind of a meat and potatoes kind of a cook, nothing too fancy. But it did give me the opportunity to really be in the kitchen with her and start at a young age to begin to develop my passion for cooking. And she had me in cooking classes during the summer when I was like 11 and 12.
Oh,
and,
really?
Yeah, and I remember winning a cake contest in about sixth grade, and my brother and I used to save empty boxes and cartons and cans, and we'd play grocery store. So there was really definitely a trend there. And as I was more and more self-taught over the years and I grew, I dreamed of going to culinary school, but at the time I was working in corporate America. I had a degree in information systems, and that's where I spent 18 years was in corporate America. But I got to the point where I knew that I absolutely had to follow my heart. I didn't want to miss that opportunity in my life. I didn't want to ever look back and say, I wish I would have. So at age 45, I found a culinary program, and I went 2 years on nights and weekends while I worked in corporate America full-time during the day, and I got my culinary degree. And then after that, a few years later, I was able to leave corporate America and start my business.
Well, that's amazing. What energy you have. That's yeah. Something I could say right now.
Yeah.
Well, now, you came to our attention because you have been a participant in the Sears Chef Challenge. Tell us what that's about.
Well, Sears came up with an idea that they wanted to do these great kind of demos in stores, and they wanted to find an up-and-coming chef in the country, and they decided to hold a Chef's Challenge. And the Chef's Challenge is taking place in four major cities in the United States, that being Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., New York, and Chicago. And there are three chefs per city in this first phase, and there will be two phases total, so 24 chefs total across the whole challenge. And we just completed our four challenges, and the nice thing is we're competing for charity. So not only are we doing the demos in stores and we're competing with one another, you know, kind of on a fun basis right now, it'll be head-to-head competition in the next phase in Chicago, but the good thing is we are raising money for food charities across the country. And I am choosing to raise money for the Saddleback Church Food Pantry, where I volunteer here in Southern California in Orange County. And then also, if we win appliances, I'm going to donate my appliances to a women's shelter, a group called the Sheepfold. And they are a group that brings in abused women and their children and help them get their lives turned around. So they have safe homes. So any of the appliances I win, I'm going to donate to the safe homes for their kitchens.
Well, that sounds wonderful. You've got
yeah, I'm
good
pretty
charities
excited about
here.
It. If I can just win some money to bless these two organizations, I will be totally happy.
Now, the chef participants were people like you. They were more like personal chefs than they were restaurant chefs, or was it open to anybody?
It was open to anybody, and there's a real mix of people. There are restaurant chefs, there are personal chefs, some are professionally trained, some are self-trained, so there is quite a breadth of talent. And if anybody was interested, on the Sears Chef Challenge website, they have all 12 pictures of the chefs, and if you click on that particular spot, the person, it'll go to their page, it'll talk a little bit about their background, and then it links to their charity that they're competing for. So there's some information out there as well.
Oh, that sounds like a great scheme.
What's the website?
Yeah. It's SearsChefChallenge.com.
Well, yeah. That sounds like it's going to benefit everybody all the way around.
It is. It's just for a really great cause, and it's been a lot of fun and a really great experience.
How do you feel? You think you're a winner?
Yeah, I feel pretty good about things. I've gotten really good feedback from a lot of people, and I think in doing this, what surprised me a little bit was that it just seems to be such a natural thing for me. I think it's a whole combination of my background of being in sales and being in corporate America and used to working with people, plus loving food and cooking so much, and my passion is really sharing that with other people. I love to teach. And when you combine all of that, doing these four demos, I was just like in my element. It was great. I had a ball. People had fun. We cooked the recipes, and we talked about cooking, and it was just really a great experience all the way around. And I felt very good. Like I said, I got some good feedback, and I've got my fingers crossed. We'll see where it goes.
Now, do you have a website as well, Susan?
Yes. Actually, I have two.
Sally.
I have my Everyday Gourmet, my business site, it's evgourmet.com. I had to shorten the domain name. So evgourmet.com is my regular business site for my personal chef and catering business. And then I write a food blog, and that is sallycameron.com. And my husband does all the photography, all the food photography for that, so we do that together. I do the writing, he does the shooting, and then he gets to eat it all.
he sounds like a lucky guy.
Yeah, he's pretty spoiled, and that's my job, is to spoil him. So, yeah, he's no complaints on his end. So we have a good time doing it, actually. And we've all four posts from the Sears Chef Challenge are out there as well, as long as all the recipes. So we talk about the experience, talk about the stores, there's all the good pictures, and then the recipes are out there as well.
And you can probably even vote through your website, too, huh?
Absolutely. Well, not on my website. You have to go to
the official one. Okay.
Yeah, the official website. And the voting is from June 26th to July 10th. You can go in and vote once a day, every day. So if anybody hears this in time, please vote for me as best chef in Los Angeles. I would love to win and be able to get the donations for those two organizations. But you can vote every day, and then they'll tally up the votes. And the best chef from each area will be named, and then those four chefs will converge in Chicago for a head-to-head competition the end of July. And that will be broadcast on the Sears Chef Challenge over their website.
Well, you must make sure to let us know how you do.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely will.
Now, how about a favorite recipe for before we go off the air? What's one of the favorites that you cook?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many things I love to cook. I'm really crazy about sauces, so I do spend a lot of time working on sauces and doing things like that. One of the fun recipes that we just did, on the third event for the Sears Chef Challenge, we were given a market basket. And there was actually a list of three different ingredient categories or groupings on the Sears Chef Challenge website that people could go in and vote for that they wanted the chefs to be challenged with. And the market basket that won had three things. It was shrimp, hominy, and jalapenos.
Wow.
So I began to
writes itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Especially living in Southern California, living in the Southwest, it just kind of yelled Southwest to me. Southwest or kind of fresh Western. And so I did a recipe of jalapeno and mint grilled shrimp along with a hominy and jalapeno a succotash, actually. And it's kind of a non-traditional succotash because it has the hominy, and instead of using lima beans, I used edamame.
They're becoming popular. I almost grew them this year.
Yeah, oh yeah, and they're so good and they're so healthy. So that's a fun recipe. It's on the Sears Chef Challenge site. It's also on my food blog, but it's easy to prepare. The flavors are very fresh and very bright, and it's a very versatile recipe because you can use the jalapeno mint vinaigrette in a variety of ways. You can skip the side dish, the succotash, and even just use the shrimp as an appetizer or as an hors d'oeuvre. So I have some of those tips out there and ways that you can use the recipes, not just for a dinner, but in other ways, too. So it's very good, and the colors are nice and bright. So, you know, the old saying that we eat with our eyes, which is very true, it's nice and colorful.
Well, you are fun to talk to with.
Thank you.
And as I said, I mean, you sound so energetic.
It's amazing. And when I get going on food, I could go on and on and on and on. It's just such a passion for me. I really enjoy it. And like I said, I love to share that with other people.
Well, I wish you luck and expect to hear big wins from you.
Oh, good. I hope so, too. I'll let you know for sure.
Okay, Sally, thanks for coming on to the program with us.
Thank you so much, Ann, and thank you, Peter, too.
Well, that pretty much wraps it for another week.
We hope you'll join us same time, same place next week at On the Menu Radio.
Bye-bye.